This week on Making Contact.
Paramilitaries are created mainly for the purpose of being able to deny human rights violations that are committed by these irregular forces, any links with government.
Human rights abuses continue to plague Mexican society. In the countryside, paramilitaries commit atrocities and terrorize villages. Bands of campesinos have been responsible for heinous murders in intercommunity disputes. And there are unsolved mass murders and rapes of young women in Ciudad Juarez. On this edition of Making Contact, we take a look at these human rights crimes and some responses from human rights organizations. We also hear from a former Mexican general imprisoned for speaking out against human rights abuses committed by the Mexican military. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Domingo Perez Gomez lives in a small government shelter in the town of Comitán. Five families share two rooms, plus a kitchen and a bathroom. Their story is not unlike many others you hear in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas, where violence, intimidation, and community disputes force groups of people from one location to another. In the span of about 10 years, Perez and the five families have had to relocate three times. A serious, perhaps life-threatening, disruption for campesinos who grow their own food. Before the shelter in Comitán, they were living in a community called Lucio Cabana in the Montes Azules jungle. Government authorities removed them in December 2002, claiming that the families were damaging the rainforest, a spurious charge levied against multiple communities in the Montes Azules and La Candona jungles. The families came to Lucio Cabana to escape violence. According to Perez, a dispute had erupted in their previous home, a place called Marques de Comilla, where they had lived for 10 years.
The killing in Marques de Comilla happened because there was an organization called MOCRI, the Regional Independent Movement for Campesinos. MOCRI accepted help from the government, but there were two resistance groups that didn't want any government interference. Although it was a struggle, the resistance groups were able to sustain themselves. MOCRI, on the other hand, became menacing. We don't know why. They killed Manuel Mendez Sanchez and his little brother. Moreover, they butchered his 11-year-old son, hitting him with a machete until he was dead.
Divisions within and between communities can be costly in Mexico. Maria Victoria Gutierrez Mendez also lives in Chiapas. She's part of a nonviolent resistance movement against the government. Other members of her community are not. She says that paramilitaries are harassing them.
There are a lot of things that they are bringing in. For example, in my community, there are things that are affecting the river we bathe in and where we drink from. And right now they are bringing in wastewater. Over there, about 2 meters from where we bathe, is the wastewater. And it's the government that's behind it. It's so that they can stay here while they make us have to go somewhere else.
These are just a couple of instances of violence and intimidation that have taken place in the countryside of Mexico. Internationally, the Mexican government is starting to assume a high profile in human rights forums, criticizing, for instance, Cuba. But back at home, there have been questions about abuses in the countryside, the Mexican military, and the government's failure to halt a decade-long string of murders in Ciudad Juarez, which is near the Texas border. Observers say these grisly rape murders of young women are spreading to other parts of northern Mexico. Besides police corruption and narco violence, some charge that gender and class discrimination are behind what's being termed femicide. Correspondent Kent Patterson files this report.
Si hablamos con un solo voz que dice ni una más.
Demonstrators demand justice on the 10th anniversary of a killing spree that's being called femicide. Since 1993, more than 340 women and girls have been murdered in Ciudad Juarez, including about 100 victims of serial rape murderers. Scores, perhaps hundreds, remain disappeared. They were students, housewives, dancers, and workers in the foreign-owned maquiladora export plants. All had one thing in common. They were poor women trying to move up in a world where all the odds were stacked against them. Like many other women, Cynthia Vasquez moved to Juarez to make a living. Vasquez says life in the border city can be terrifying for women.
I get a bit panicky when it starts getting late. You hurry up and do what you have to do because you have to get home early. But you run a risk and you don't know who's going to take care of you. My boss had a niece that was abducted. Parts of a girl's body were returned in a bag, a very sad thing. They said the police did DNA tests to see if they matched the girl, but the body parts returned were not hers.
In Juarez, many women have stories. Gloria Solis is the mother of Myra Reyes, who disappeared 2 years ago. The young woman was possibly last seen trying to get paperwork from the Echo Computer School where she had worked. At least 11 young women, who reportedly had some kind of contact with this private school, have disappeared and/or turned up raped and murdered. Gloria Solis says she encountered the cold indifference that faces other distraught mothers in Juarez.
When I went to the school, I found out they issued the paperwork on Tuesdays and Fridays. I asked them if they would tell me whether my daughter had come to get her paperwork. They told me I needed to give them her code number, so I told them her name to give me the paperwork under her name. They told me they needed her number, and I wasn't able to verify whether she had gone to the school after she had disappeared.
In Juarez, which is right next door to El Paso, Texas, young women like Myra Reyes, who disappear, then become a number on a police file. Jimena Andion works with the Mexico City-based Commission for the Defense and Promotion of Human Rights, which advocates on behalf of victims' families.
A message is being sent that the lives of women don't mean a thing. All this is fomenting a culture of discrimination and aversion to women. A message is also being sent out that the social fabric is under stress and the rule of law threatened. This is all very grave and could result in a situation where anything could happen and the law of the jungle prevails, not only in Ciudad Juarez, but in the rest of the country as well.
Here on these downtown streets, shoe and music stores, gift shops, and computer schools attract a steady clientele of young women. Some vanish into the haunted memories of a city that's a magnet for people trying to enter the United States or find work in the maquiladora plants. Lorena Mendez is a California-based television producer and activist who has documented the Juarez tragedy.
They continue attracting workers that come from El Sur, you know, from Veracruz, from Michoacán, Zacatecas. You know, in many of the cases that we've come across, we even have some of the women who have been victimized that are from Central America as well.
While life in Juarez revolves around an export-driven economy of both people and goods, it is also dominated by another global industry that some researchers tie to the women's murders.
Bueno, es un asunto que ha crecido a lo largo de la investigación.
Mexican journalist Sergio González Rodríguez is the author of Huesos en el Desierto, Bones in the Desert, an investigative account of the Juarez serial murders. González questions the arrests of several suspects and says leads point instead to wealthy businessmen and organized crime figures who rape, torture, and kill young women in orgies that bond together a criminal fraternity.
There's a network of protection that consists of police and public officials. It goes from the municipal level up to the state and then the federal level. Likewise, the involvement of organized crime, especially drug traffickers, is present here.
Si recordamos que el crimen organizado en Ciudad Juárez funciona.
González says it's no coincidence that initially the bodies of many female victims were dumped near ranches where also the male murder victims of drug traffickers were later recovered. Juarez boasts a long history as a center of vice, but in recent years, geopolitics have given rise to a powerful drug cartel that has virtually taken over the town.
Esto sucedió durante la época de los años 70.
This all happened back in the 1970s when the guerrilla movement was important in Central America and represented a high risk to U.S. foreign policy. We can't forget that the U.S. government, especially through secret agencies like the CIA, hatched the Iran-Contra affair. This scheme proposed to deliver arms to the Central American counter-revolutionaries. In return, the Central Americans supplied drugs to the U.S. market. All this is well documented, but I mention it because this is the origin of the hidden participation of the Mexican and U.S. governments with the Mexican drug cartels.
After a decade of femicide and impunity, several women's groups filed a complaint with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington, D.C. They charged the Mexican government with not living up to international agreements that oblige it to protect the rights of women to be free from violence and discrimination. Jimena Andion of the Commission for the Defense and Promotion of Human Rights.
I don't think we can speak about a democratic transition in Mexico while situations like the one in Ciudad Juarez continue, as long as there is such impunity and discrimination in this country. While these issues aren't addressed, I don't think we will be able to move toward a democratic society.
The Inter-American Commission recently held the Mexican government responsible for fostering impunity and urged authorities to become actively involved in curbing the violence. This came on the heels from a similar call by a United Nations subcommittee. Meanwhile, similar killings and disappearances of women are now being reported in Chihuahua City, Nuevo Laredo, Nogales, and other Mexican cities. 10 years after the murders began, questions linger over the killing fields of Juarez. Would these crimes have gone on for so long had the victims been from rich families? Is an entire generation of young, low-income women at risk? For Making Contact, I'm Kent Patterson in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
We'll have more on Mexico and human rights abuses in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information about this program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for CD or cassette copies. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. As a result of the Zapatista Army's peasant revolt of 1994 and subsequent negotiations with the Mexican government in 1996, 38 indigenous-led autonomous zones were created in the southern state of Chiapas. But as the talks fell apart, the government reintroduced a military presence into the autonomous zones. Las Abejas, which means the bees in Spanish, was a successful group of collective coffee and honey farmers that helped finance one of the autonomous zones. The PRI, the ruling Mexican party at the time, carried out a campaign of terror by confiscating their crops, their equipment, burning down their homes, and ultimately forcing them off their land. Las Abejas took refuge in the mountain town of Acteal. John Ross, an author and journalist living in Mexico City, wrote about what happened on December 22, 1997, in a book called The War Against Oblivion, The Zapatista Chronicles.
The men from Quixtique gathered at the elbow of the road above the Abejas encampment in Acteal early on the second morning of winter. Their collective breath seeping into the chill mountain air through the red kerchiefs that masked all but their dark, angry eyes. The priistas were impatient to get the killing done, and the tardiness of their compañeros coming from Los Choros did not improve their disposition. Now, the men dressed in dark uniforms stomped through the damp underbrush past the hand-lettered sign planted just below the road that read, Peace, Neutral Zone, firing as they descended, For a while, the killers seemed content to just demonstrate their firepower to the refugees crouched on the promontory below. But when a detachment of state police pulled into the school 200 meters above, the signal was given to advance down the hillside. By mid-morning, Akdiala was mostly a woman's camp. The men had gone off to salvage what they could of their coffee from the playistas. Most of the Abeja women were clustered around a clapboard chapel where they picked through a pile of old clothes donated by the diocese. Others prayed fervently for peace with the zone's lead catechist, Alonso Vasquez, who had called upon the devoutly Christian bees to celebrate 3 days of prayer and fasting in preparation for the marking of Christ's birthday. Alonso had been forewarned of the coming violence, but had stubbornly refused to leave. One day before, an Abeja from Kishtik, who had been captured by the priistas to cut down and haul the stolen coffee, escaped his kidnappers and came down to Akdiala to warn of the preparations of the death squad, but the catechist would not run. We have done nothing wrong. Now the Abejas had to run, but there was no place to run to. Alonso's wife was the first to fall. "Forgive them, for they know not what they do," legend has it, the catechist cried out as he took 8 AR-15 slugs in the back. Manuel, his 10-year-old son, who stayed hidden in the underbrush, remembers what happened next. "The killers stood there laughing at my mother, and then they killed her again and took out a knife and cut open her stomach and took out the baby that was in there and threw it away." The Abejas have always counted the unborn baby as one of the victims. With the bullets raining down on the woodboard chapel, the women were rat-trapped out on the ledge of the promontory. Many dashed wildly downhill into the leafy gully at the bottom of which a thin ribbon of an arroyo gurgled. Some sought cover behind boulders or in a cleft of the mountain that forms a sort of cave, their attackers methodically advancing in pursuit, hunting the victims down with automatic weapons and mutilating their bodies with machete cuts. The massacre was slow and systematic, the men in the red masks taking their sweet time. Short bursts of gunfire echoed off the hillside well into the afternoon. By the time the solstice-shortened sun had begun to drop from the sky, there were 45 dead at Akdiala, 7 men, 19 women, and 19 children, 46, say the Abejas. Throughout the massacre, the police had been posted up by the road where the gunfire was plainly audible. At 11:30, Cornelio Perez, one of the Zapatista bases who were encamped with the Abejas on the hillside, but who had taken cover in the mountain after the warning the day before, ran up to the road to plead with the police detachment to stop the killing. Comandante Roberto Rivas was standing on the lip of the highway, perhaps 50 meters from the death scene, but instead of taking action to stop the bloodshed, he took Cornelio Perez into custody. At the same hour, 11:30, Jose Hernandez, another Zapatista partisan, ran to the public phone by the road and frantically dialed up the diocese in San Cristobal. Gonzalo Ituarte took the information and put in an emergency call to the state secretary of government in Tuxtla Gutierrez, the state capital. Homero Tobilla seemed unimpressed but promised to check out the rumor. A call was made to the Chiapas Public Safety Director, General Jorge Gamboa Solis, who in turn rang up the mixed operations base at Mahumut, close enough to Akdiala to have heard the gunshots, and was told that everything was quiet. Sin novedad, in military parlance, without news. All throughout the night, The forces of public security labored to rearrange the killing site. Six trenches were dug down in the gully. The bodies were collected and stacked, perhaps to be burnt. Before dawn on the 23rd, State Attorney General Jorge Enrique Hernandez and his assistant Uriel Harkin arrived to control the body count and get the corpses out of Acteal before the press and the human rights people showed up in the daylight. The ravaged hunks of flesh that had once been the abejas were slung up in the trucks and carried down to Tuxtla for the autopsies.
That was John Ross, reading from his book, The War Against Oblivion, The Zapatista Chronicles. The investigations into Acteal never determined who was responsible for giving the orders or planning the massacre. Individuals directly involved in the massacre were sentenced. Some have since been released, and others may soon follow. Diego Zavala of Amnesty International says it's a challenge to hold the Mexican military accountable for human rights abuses.
Indigenous communities in Chiapas, in Oaxaca, in Guerrero, where the military presence is strong, creates a lot of tension, a lot of stress in the community, especially among indigenous women, because they are at risk of sexual harassment or at worst being raped. And of the cases that Amnesty International has documented, the military had failed to investigate these incidents, or when they investigated, they always had concluded that the members of the military were innocent or that the incident didn't happen.
One of the whistleblowers of the military has come from within its ranks. General Francisco Gallardo was one of the youngest brigadier generals in the Mexican Army. But his open critique of human rights violations by the Mexican Army landed him a lengthy jail sentence in 1993. When General Gallardo went into the Mexican military school in 1963, he thought he'd be able to develop himself as a person in the Army. Instead, he was disturbed by the hazing practices in the military, ranging from practical jokes to executions.
One example of what they did to us in military school was put shoe polish on our feet and set them on fire. Another time they stuck needles under our fingernails. I thought that upon graduating military school and becoming an official, things would get better. But that wasn't the case. Some of the cadets killed as a result of these hazing practices had their bodies returned to their families. The Army told their families that they had been killed in acts of service. And while I was at Jalisco as a commander, a group of 15 students from the University of Guadalajara had been detained and were brought to the base where they were tortured and beaten. I brought them food and blankets. When my superiors found out, I was sanctioned and relieved of my charge. Then I was transferred from the base on Jalisco to the state of Chihuahua, over 1,000 kilometers away. Later, I found out that the students were executed and thrown out of a plane into Lake Chapala in the state of Jalisco. These experiences caused me to go around to different military schools and institutions, searching for answers to what I was seeing, but I never found any.
General Gallardo began to look outside the military for answers. In 1979, at the rank of major, the military sent him to teach in Mexico City. While there, he started studying political science and public administration at a nearby civilian university. By the time he had his doctorate, he was a general. He presented his graduate dissertation to a group of generals, proposing the creation of a military overview committee to investigate human rights violations in the military. But the trouble began when a Mexican weekly magazine published his dissertation. He was immediately charged with poor administration of military resources and stealing military horse feed. He was sentenced to 28 years in prison. The following year, General Gallardo was declared a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International. Amnesty International's Zavala.
In retrospect, it was quite a courageous thing to do. Historically, the military in Mexico has enjoyed almost complete impunity for its actions against human rights. And therefore, when someone within their own ranks And more so if it's a brigadier general calls for an ombudsman office, then certainly doesn't fit with the internal power structure. So I think that that position that he took was a very courageous and expensive one.
His imprisonment was a difficult strain on Gallardo's family. At the time of his arrest, he had three sons and a daughter only a few months old. Every Sunday, his family brought him his food for a week because they were afraid he'd be fed poisoned food, and his family was receiving death threats.
Como en México quedó demostrado que no se respeta la ley.
Because in Mexico, there was a lack of respect for the law and justice, we took the case to the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. After 2 years of evaluating the case, the commission made a resolution saying that there had been a violation of human rights in the case. In its preliminary findings, the commission was looking for an amicable resolution to the conflict and asked both the Mexican government and myself if we would be willing to negotiate. This resolution was based on the Inter-American Human Rights Convention on Human Rights. According to the Mexican Constitution, this international treaty is equivalent to the supreme law of the land. So when the commission asked if we would be willing to negotiate, I said yes, I would negotiate. I don't see any other way to resolve a conflict that involves institutions without negotiating. However, the Mexican government and the Secretary of Defense said they don't negotiate with criminals. So on October 15, 1996, the Inter-American Human Rights Committee came down with its final resolution saying that it had detected an abuse of powers. So as the Mexican government has representatives in the Organization of American States, they had advance notice about the resolution and sent a group of generals to come visit me in prison and offer me release. This group of 10 generals tried to convince me to accept this offer for release. They gave me a list of charges like a menu that I could choose from and decide which charges I wanted to be guilty of. This demonstrated that it was a political rather than a legal issue. I told these generals that dignity and human rights are not negotiable. Either there's dignity or there's not. I also told them to tell the Secretary of Defense that I don't negotiate with criminals.
Gallardo's imprisonment initiated a national debate about human rights and the army. As international pressure mounted, it was hard to keep him in prison. So in 2002, after over 8 years in prison, he was freed. Now Gallardo has become a leader in the human rights community in Mexico. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Ming-En Chang, Mickey Mays, Jimena Quiroga, Bodie Garrett, and Anne Bacon. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for a cassette or CD copy of the program. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Peggy Law founding director, managing producer Philip Babich, office manager Rosalyn Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national advisor David Barsamian, and I'm your host and associate producer Amy Pomerlow. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time,